Well, this question is going to be fairly easy to answer, I think. What we're talking about and the insert. Who can tell me what the fifth basic unity's fifth basic principle is? Walk the talk, that's right. In unity, we don't have a whole lot of dogma. We don't have a lot of you do this and you have to do that. But we do have five basic principles. And the fifth one is that it isn't enough that we know the truth principles. It is ours to do to practice them, to walk the talk, to do what we can, to live the life that we want to be, the life that Jesus Christ modeled and taught. Walk our talk. Daring greatly. This book that we've been looking at this whole month also expects us, if we want to dare greatly, if we want to be authentic, if we want to be vulnerable, all these things we've been talking about, we have to walk the talk. In daring greatly, walking the talk means that we want to be what we say that we want to be. I don't know about you, but I have great intentions. I want to do this. I have a number of projects started around my house that aren't finished yet. I have two bags of mulch out in the garage that are going to get to, what I want and what I do sometimes aren't completely in sync, but it is my goal to get them in sync. When I really stop and look at how that is maybe a mismatch, it makes me uncomfortable. All that we've been talking about this month with daring greatly, it started with a quote by Teddy Roosevelt, the speech that he did, talking about going into the arena and getting dirty and sweaty and bloody. And those who do that feel the thrill of accomplishment when they succeed. And even if they don't succeed, they feel pride and a sense of, I gave it my best. They dared greatly. That's what we want. That's what we've been talking about all this time. To do that, we need to be vulnerable. And that's where the discomfort comes in. This week, as we wrap this up, Brené Brown talks about something called minding the gap. And that gap is exactly that. It is the difference between what we say we want to be and who we actually are, the way we're showing up. She talks about something called strategy versus culture. Strategy, probably not surprisingly, is when we are thinking in our lives, thinking about a goal that we want to achieve, how we're going to achieve it, the steps we're going to take to get there. That's the strategy. That's the game plan, if you will, versus culture. Culture is the way we do things. How many times in your organizations or schools or families even, that's the way we've always done it? You heard that? Yeah, yeah. That's culture, and culture has us doing things sometimes that aren't even written down, but we know what the rules are. She talks about something called a disengagement divide. It is what she says, the space between the disengagement divide. It's that space between, she calls them, practiced values versus aspirational values. What we say we want to be and what we show up being. She has some wonderful examples. Let me share with you. An aspirational value of honesty and integrity. We want to be honest and full of integrity, right? Yes? Okay. The practice values might be rationalizing and letting things slide. An example, mom is always telling her kids that honesty and integrity are important and that stealing and cheating at school won't be tolerated. As they pile into the car after a grocery shopping trip, Mom realizes that the cashier didn't charge her for the sodas on the bottom of the cart. Rather than going back into the store, she shrugs and says, "Wasn't my fault. They're making a mint anyway." Rationalizing and letting things be is practiced values versus honesty and integrity. The difference, the gap. Second one, aspirational values, respect and accountability. The practiced value, fast and easy is more important. Perhaps this is an example. Dad is always driving home the importance of respect and accountability, but when Bobby intentionally breaks Sammy's new transformer, Dad is too busy on his BlackBerry to sit down with the brothers and talk about how they should treat each other's toys. Instead of insisting that Bobby needs to apologize and make amends, he shrugs his shoulders, thinking boys will be boys, and tells them both to go to their rooms. Aspirational values, gratitude and respect. The practiced values, teasing, taking for granted, disrespect. Mom and dad constantly feel unappreciated, and they're tired of their children's disrespectful attitudes. But mom and dad themselves yell at each other and call each other names. No one in the house says please or thank you, including the parents. Moreover, mom and dad use put-downs with their children and with each other, and everyone routinely teases family members to the point of tears. The problem is that the parents are looking for behaviors, emotions, and thinking patterns that their children have never seen modeled. These are the kinds of things, the examples of what it's like when there is one of these gaps, these disengagement divides. I remember a time a long time ago when I worked at Bell, and I had to go out at lunch to get, I think, glue sticks or something for my daughter for school. And I was in a meeting with a woman, you know, casual meeting, but we were talking, and I said, "Oh, I have to go to lunch. I need to buy this glue stick." And she said, "Well, why don't you just go to the supply cabinet? There are lots in there." No, no. Little tiny things, but when you do something little, then the next step and the next step and the next step, there's that disengagement divide. Who we say we are, what our values are, and the way we really, really act. Minding the gap, she says, takes great courage. We already know that vulnerability feels uncomfortable. Everybody know? It's kind of scary, because when we put ourselves out there to be authentic, to be real, to ask for what we need, to say what's on our mind, we're being vulnerable, and we risk rejection or criticism or who knows what. So this vulnerability can be frightening. Minding the gap of who we say and what we're doing, she says, requires that we do something called disruptive engagement. Now, she has a quote. She says, "Honest conversations about vulnerability and shame are disruptive." Can you see why? Honest conversations about shame and vulnerability are disruptive. It is so much easier to just kind of do things the way we've always done them, to stay in our comfortable little ways of dealing with people and life and all of that. But to be real, if someone says, when this happens, I feel such and such, if we don't want to run back into the rabbit hole, we can stay there and say, "Tell me more." It is disruptive. It's disruptive of the way things have always been, the way we've always handled things. Up to today, we have talked mostly, I think, about this vulnerability and daring greatly in terms of ourselves, you know, just for our own benefits. We've said this is so that we can be all that we can be, you know, that we can grow this Christ self. Today, I'm going to ask you to think about daring greatly in terms of the relationships that you have, the family structures, the systems that you're in, the place where you work or school. In those places, we want to practice disruptive engagement. We'll talk more about that. She uses a term, you know, leader, which is not unusual, but in her definition, it isn't exactly what we've been used to hearing a leader is. In terms of daring greatly, a leader is anyone who holds him or herself accountable for finding potential in people and processes. Now, think about that for a minute. So if a leader, now think about your boss perhaps. Is your experience when you worked for a boss in your company that you felt like your boss was looking for potential in you? Good. I had a couple in all my years. People don't always do that. More often I felt like I was working for someone who was waiting for me to do something wrong, and I would feel criticized. So this idea of a leader being anyone who holds himself or herself for accountable for finding the potential implies more of a team approach, doesn't it? Yes. So when we're thinking about this leader idea then, and think about the situations that we're all in, we might find that when people are not being vulnerable, we might find that shame and blame have moved in. Disengagement happens when we feel like we are shamed, when we feel like we are blamed. You know, we're going to step back if we know that someone is going to be critical, watching us, you know, waiting. We probably are going to disengage. We're going to not give the best that we can. We're not going to be creative. What we lose when we disengage, whether it's us, our organization, or a part of one that we're in, families or whatever, we lose creativity, we lose engagement, we lose the involvement of ourselves and everyone. Disengagement is the biggest threat to having a daring greatly kind of environment, a vulnerable kind of environment. Some signs of shame. She says, and I thought it was really a good analogy, she said that shame works like termites. So if you think about walking around in your home, you might not see anything for a good while if termites are at work. You know? And by the time you do see symptoms of termites, there's considerable damage. Shame is like that. If there is shame that is prevalent in an organization or in a relationship, the symptoms are going to, by the time you see them, it's going to be it's already pretty damaged. So some signs of shame in culture are blaming. Do you remember the video that we had a week or two ago? Damn you, Steve. You remember that?
Yeah.
It was really cute. She dropped the cup of coffee. He was nowhere around, for those of you who weren't here. An animated little cartoon thing on blame. Dropped a cup of coffee. The cup broke. Coffee spilled up on her white slacks and her pink sweater. And the first thing that came to her mind was, damn you, Steve. and it was, she went through this diagram of how that happened. You know, why it was his fault that she dropped that cup of coffee. And we do that. Blaming, gossip. Sometimes it feels like it's fun to gossip, but it's very, particularly if it's negative, it's very damaging. It's one of those termite kind of things. It will erode the organization, whatever relationship. Favoritism is another one. Do you remember the Smothers Brothers? Mom always liked you best. Just popped in my head. Name calling and harassment. Those are signs of shame in culture. And when there is shame, people disengage. in my family, I caught myself way back. It was a family reunion, and I think my cousin, like my favorite cousin, had been teasing my sister about her hair or something, and I snapped back with another put down teasing kind of thing. And afterwards, I was embarrassed and I was ashamed that I had done that. I don't like put down humor. There was a lot of it. That was kind of the way our family worked, and I had tried to get out of it. There's a gap. That is not who and what I want to be. It was just right there. Because people disengage. And there's a part of you, even if you say, oh, I'm just kidding. Well, why did you say? It's just, there's a part of you that makes you, just wonders, is there something in there? Why would you even say that? So, the blame game. We've already talked about, it says, in shame-bound relationships, people measure carefully, weigh, and assign blame. And that's what we saw Brené Brown doing. It's rampant. You know, people seem to want someone else to blame. I don't want it to be my fault, so it has to be somebody else's fault. I'm going to do what I can to try and find someone to blame. She said, and it says in the book, blame is the discharging of pain and discomfort. It's a way of releasing that, but not a very constructive way, and certainly then we risk that disengagement thing. So we want to do disruptive engagement. We want to stop some of these ways of behaving that we have done before. She says we want to rehumanize education and work. And I think we talked last week, remember, about her reaction when she noticed people not even making eye contact, not even just even the minimum civil interchange with people. We want to rehumanize our relationships with people. We are all in this together. So, one of the major ways I think that she talks about doing this is with feedback. Who has ever been a boss, a supervisor who has had to give feedback? It's uncomfortable. Was for me, was it for you to do it? Being on the receiving end isn't a picnic either. I remember when the one-minute manager thing came along. So then there's formula for that is there's a compliment and then here's what you do wrong. So we all learned really quickly that when somebody said something nice,
yeah.
Okay, yeah, and what? So feedback is really scary if we don't know how to do it well. If we don't know how to do it well. A couple of things. She said one thing that is important to do is to normalize discomfort. Because if we are up there and we are in the arena, whether receiving feedback or giving feedback, rehumanizing this, the idea is to normalize discomfort. To say, I'm a little nervous about this, or this isn't, you know, this makes me a little uncomfortable, but I think together we can figure something. You know, whatever it takes, normalize it. If you're feeling uncomfortable, they probably are too. Normalize it. She says, and this I thought was a great example, that when she teaches apparently at University of Houston, and she said that when her students come in at the beginning of the term, she tells them right away, if you're comfortable, I'm not doing my job. As a teacher. She said that she knew it was working because at one point after, you know, some time and the course had gone by, she said that someone came up to her, a student, and said, I'm still feeling comfortable. I'm worried I'm not getting something. So it was great. That was exactly what she wanted because we don't like to feel like we don't know anything. Remember the change from, well, back when my day it was junior high to senior high? You go from being the top dog, you know, to the lowest grade again. Whether it's high school, senior year, yay, I'm all powerful, to being a freshman in college, I know nothing. You know, a new job, same thing. You go from being maybe an expert in what you did do to being a newbie again. All of those can be scary. We can feel very vulnerable in those sorts of situations. But if we understand that doing something new, trying something new, daring greatly, we're going to feel uncomfortable, and that's normal. That's normal. In the feedback process, she said that vulnerability is the heart of the feedback process. It isn't. You know, I worked there at Bell for 31 years, so I've had a number of feedback sessions with bosses and so forth. Some went well, some were less than great. some were almost, were dehumanizing, you know, just sort of, well, read this and tell me which. But one guy even said, write something and I'll sign it, you know. Okay? I've done it, you know, like, all right, but did I learn anything? Nothing, you know. She gives an example of, she calls it sitting on the same side of the desk. And it's a wonderful approach. Because if you're going to meet with someone, I learned this in when I thought I was going to be a counselor, that if you have a client come in, don't have a desk between you, to sit down together. And it just changes all of the energy. Because now we're sitting here together. We're sitting next to each other. And if you keep that whole mindset of togetherness, and again, from the counseling model, we learned about a, I think I was talking with Jeanette last week, there was a pretty famous theorist, Carl Rogers, and it was called the Rogerian theory. He said that the therapist should always hold the client in unconditional positive regard. Now, take it out of the therapist-client mode and think about your family. Someone that you're mad at, a sibling maybe you're mad at, or someone who has said something terrible, or, you know, a work environment or school environment. Think about it there. If you were to hold a person in unconditional positive regard, if you're sitting on the same side of the desk, if you can come at it from a place of, let's talk about this situation. We're being vulnerable. We're inviting them to be vulnerable. And we have much greater chances of together creating something new, you know, learning and growing. She says, when an environment is one of these daring, greatly vulnerable kind of environment, you will hear phrases like these. I don't know. I need help. I'd like to give it a shot. It's important to me. I disagree. Can we talk about it? It didn't work, but I learned a lot. Yes, I did it. Here's what I need. Here's how I feel. I'd like some feedback. Can I get your take on this? What can I do better next time? Can you teach me how to do that? I played a part in that. I accept responsibility for that. I'm here for you. I want to help. Let's move on. I'm sorry. That means a lot to me. Thank you. Aren't they wonderful? Just all of those kinds of things. If we can relate to people, work with people in these kinds of ways, it's like we're walking a path together. It isn't a critical, judgmental, shaming, blaming kind of feeling. It's vulnerability at its finest. There's the last full chapter is about parenting, but as I went through the material, I realized that it's not just about how we treat our children, it's about how we treat each other. My son is 40, you know, and so when I was reading some of these things, I could apply them easily to my son, an adult, and I could apply them with my friends. It has to do with sitting on the same side of the desk. So one of the things that she said, and I thought it was a really good tip on how we're going to deal with people, how we're going to use these principles, this engagement, being vulnerable, all of that. One of them was, when you see someone walk in the room, let your face show your joy at seeing them. When I was a mom, I was very entrenched in the idea that it was my job to teach my child everything that I possibly could. And so if I saw my son come in the door and his shoe was untied, it could be that the first thing that I had on my face was not, "I'm happy to see you, your shoe's untied," a critical thing. She says it's important. Let your face show your joy when you see your children, when you see your friends, when you see your coworkers. Think about this. If you walk into someone's office or classroom or even your family's bedroom, and the person that's sitting that you're approaching glances up and then looks right back down and keeps doing whatever they're doing, there's a disconnect. But if that person looks up and smiles, it's a whole different feeling. Let your face show your joy at seeing the person. Mind your words. Sometimes it's kind of subtle, but it makes a big difference. The difference between you told a lie and you're a liar. You know, if I said that to you, you know, if I said you told a lie, you might get some defensive, but it's about something you did, clearly. If I say you're a liar, that's harsh. It's saying this is the way you are. And that's true for ourselves. Oh, Sharon, you are such a, name it, when we say it to other people, you are, we can always say to someone else and to ourselves, I wasn't happy with the way I did that, I wasn't happy with the way you did that, let's talk about something different, versus you're a klutz, be mindful of our words, because we can slip into that shame thing, that shame culture really easily, and it that gap between who we say we want to be and who we are widens. So mind your words. And then belonging versus fitting in. When you think about that, does that at first sound like it's kind of the same thing? But there were some kids, she asked some kids, and they answered, and this was so powerful, I thought. So true. I think she asked middle schoolers. 8th graders, come up with the differences between fitting in and belonging, and here are 3 answers. Belonging is being somewhere where you want to be and they want you. Fitting in is being somewhere where you really want to be, but they don't care one way or the other. I've been both. You? Belonging is being accepted for you. Fitting in is being accepted for being like everyone else. And last, I get to be me if I belong. I have to be like you to fit in. So when we're dealing with others, you know, if we can do these things, if we can keep in mind, we want to be vulnerable. Appropriately. We want to be engaged with others. We want to show that we want to work together, whether the feedback is formal or not, on the giving or the receiving end, if we can show up and be ourselves and show that we're sitting on the same side of the desk in reality or metaphorically, we're going to be way happier. And so will everyone around us. As we wind up this time with this amazing book, I think, Brené Brown, I think that if we can keep hold of some of these notions and remember our oneness, as unity teaches, and remember that our authenticity is very important to know and to feel our oneness, it will put us ahead eons in our quest to be all that we can be. I wanted to just finish up with a story. This is, she said that she had a conversation with a guy who was in his early 20s. She said that she tells about how his parents had sent him to TED Talks, and he really bought into this whole idea of daring greatly. He had been dating a young woman for a while, and he really had feelings for her, so he decided that he would tell her how he felt, and he told her that he loved her. Brené Brown says that she kind of, you know, winced when he told her that he said that to this young woman, because he was, you know, there he was. And the young woman said that she thought that he was awesome, appreciated it, but felt like she wasn't ready to be tied down to one person, and she wanted for both of them to date other people too. He got back to his room and told his two roommates that what he had done, and one of them said, "What were you thinking, man?" One of his roommates told him that girls only like guys who are running the other way. And at first he said that his reaction was like, "Oh, I did it wrong." And then he remembered, and then he said, "I told my roommates I was daring greatly, dude." They stopped typing, looked at me, nodded their heads, and said, "Oh, right on, dude." So if you remember that excerpt from the speech about going into the arena, Brené Brown finishes this book with these. She says, "So, Mr. Roosevelt, I think you nailed it. There really is no effort without error and shortcoming, and there really is no triumph without vulnerability. Now when I read that quote, even when I'm feeling kicked around, all I can think is, right on, dude." Let's take a little time now, as we do each week, to practice our oneness, to again make that connection with Source, with God. So I invite you to, if you haven't already, gently close your outer eyes and take a deep breath in. Hold it for just a moment and release. Do that again, in, hold, and release, letting your body let go and release as you do so. Breathe deeply and slowly, and feel yourself relaxing. Feel yourself being supported by your seat. Feel your body untensing. Feel the muscles in your face relaxing and letting go, your jaw loosening, shoulders dropping down. Breathe. When we do this practice of simply being still and breathing, we allow ourselves to put aside all of the busyness, both in the outer and in our minds. As we allow ourselves to relax and just be, just breathe, we open ourselves once again to that connection, that realization of the truth of who and what we are. And as we do this morning, keeping our focus on breath, breathing in and releasing, being still, being quiet, we may well find a wonderful sense of safety, a sense of all is well right now, right here. We may connect with peace, that peace that Jesus talked about that has nothing to do with anything in the outer and has everything to do with that inner highest self and our connection with it. At our very core, we are peace. As Pat said earlier, we remember who and what is with us at all times. We can never feel afraid or lonely or weak when we are in that awareness. And that's what we focus on now. We are one with our Creator. In this oneness, we have access to anything and everything we need. Guidance. All we need to do is open our minds. We may begin to notice other people's conversations. A phrase on a radio program that answers a question. Overhearing a conversation. Guidance comes. Sometimes it's just a knowing. If we need strength, we go to that place of oneness, that place of quiet, that place of just breathing. And we can feel ourselves begin to take on that attribute of strength. We tap into that inner power that is always there. And once again can feel like, I can do this. With God, I can do all things. In this oneness, this quiet, stillness, we experience love. This love, this experience of love is just the feeling, the experience of what we are. It is said that God is love, and as the offspring of our Creator, we too can manifest love. We always have a choice. And as we are doing right now, are choosing now to be still, to be open, to be receptive, to realize our oneness, to be aware of this connection, we manifest peace. We manifest love. We become that light in the world, that light of peace, that light of love, through no effort of our own. As we do each week, let us now take some time in silence to experience this quiet, experience this oneness, to simply be. in the silence. We are grateful. Grateful for the peace that lifts the heaviness of the world off of our shoulders. Grateful for the love that allows us to feel loved, connected, anywhere, anytime. Grateful for the awareness of this inner power. Grateful for the divine ideas that flow to us and give us guidance. We are grateful for these people in this room that support us on our spiritual path as we come together each week. We're grateful for our families, our friends, all of the many blessings we have in our lives. We are grateful for this beautiful day. And we are grateful for all the blessings that we know are still on their way to us. And so we complete our time of contemplation, of prayer, by coming together in love and in gratitude as we say together our Lord's Prayer. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver. Thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever. Amen.